mentioned earlier, the Mothers of Invention will be performing at the Ford Auditorium in Detroit on December 1st. And they will be performing in Ann Arbor at the Fifth Dimension on December 2nd and 3rd. Last Monday in Detroit, I talked with Frank Zappa, the leader and musical director of the Mothers of Invention, and asked him what differences we could expect between live performance and recordings.
Oh, about 500%. Because what we do on stage bears little or no resemblance to what we do on a record, because I conceive them as two different mediums. And the way we approach the two different mediums is, you know, like, we really don't even make an attempt to play a lot of the songs that we've recorded.
Can you give an example between the differences, how you might...
Well, our repertoires are completely different. The songs that we record, or this, at least the way we've been operating for the past 8 months, the stuff that we've recorded, we don't even bother trying to learn it for the bandstand, because the things we do on the stand are suited to live performance. The arrangements have been adjusted so that they're acoustically feasible in large hall environments, rather than trying to simulate the delicate effects that might be achieved on a record. We come out and do the things that are going to sound good when you play it loud, and we have a visual presentation that accompanies the program. We do things with our hands and bodies on stage that don't record well. And there is a big difference between what we sound like on records and what we sound like live. On records, we tend to eliminate improvisation. There's no long solo things except on Absolutely Free. There's a 6-minute, you know, group improvisation, but we do a lot of that on stage. The guys really are proficient players, and we just blow our brains out mostly.
Now, speaking of recordings, I understand you have a new album coming out.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
I have a new album called We're Only In It for the Money, and we're having a problem with the release of this album due to the cover of the album. We had a problem with Absolutely Free, too. It took 7 months before the problem with Absolutely Free was straightened out. We hope this problem won't take that long. We're Only In It for the Money is completely different than the other two albums. It doesn't even sound like the same band.
On your albums, I'm sure most of the people who will be hearing your concerts will be familiar with them.
Many won't, because a lot of people come to see us just out of curiosity. Okay. I found that most people have not heard our music, but might have heard the name of the group mentioned and think that maybe it'd be better than watching television to go out tonight and see this freak show. And we usually give them what they're looking for.
For their benefit, on the albums you come across as being very bitter. And
you really think so?
Yes. Well, you come across to me as being bitter. Mm-hmm. It strikes me as odd or ironic that the society that you're criticizing up and down for its plasticity and so on, your message is conveyed to it via vinyl records distributed by short cigar-smoking promotion men, you know.
Even tall cigar-smoking promotion men, I could name you some. And I even go out there and talk with those promotion men. And I make sure that the products that we manufacture are packaged in such a way that those promotion men can make money from selling them. And that means they're going to order more of them the next time. We've had successive increases in initial orders in albums. Like, initial orders on Freak Out were 15,000. 0 to 15,000, first time out. Second album, initial orders were 45,000. On the third album, the orders, without even seeing the cover or knowing anything about the album, it's about 85,000 advance orders. See, this is because the distributors know they're going to make a buck on it. I'm happy that they can earn the money, because that does just that much more in getting the so-called bitter message out to the public that needs to hear it.
Yeah, the point I'm making is...
it is ironic,
is this an accurate, isn't it? Is this an accurate representation of your feelings? Or do you overdo
it? I'm pretty p***ed off, yeah.
What are you doing in America?
What am I doing in America?
Why are you here? Why don't you split?
Why should I leave? I like America. I like to see it turn out better.
America is wonderful.
Yeah, well, I've always felt that it had a chance to be wonderful if we could just get some people into the positions of control that really cared about what was happening. I just get tired of seeing a bunch of running everything. But unfortunately, the so-called youth revolution, which a lot of people talk about in whispers at the coffee shop, and how we're going to take over someday, buddy, and all this stuff. If it were to happen tomorrow, it would be a bull thing because the kids aren't really prepared to run anything. They have no real sense of responsibility, and most of them are so apathetic that if they had a chance to run their own lives or run the government or run somebody else's life, they'd fail miserably. They know nothing of politics, and they know nothing of workable systems. And not only that, they don't want to know. So something's got to be done to make them interested. And unfortunately, it's probably going to have to be a thing where the techniques of Madison Avenue are going to have to be used to sell the idea of responsibility to enough people of a certain age so that when the time comes and they are the majority and they do have to be faced with the problems of running their own country, that they're going to be in some shape to do it. But I would panic out if all of a sudden we had some 18-year-old president tomorrow. Scare me to death. But in 10 years, maybe, it'd be good, you know, if something like that could be engineered.
You mentioned having difficulty getting your albums released, particularly because of the cover. Do you find that you have to compromise your artistry for the public, or do you do what you want to do, more or less, and then push it on them somewhere?
I think that we have more freedom, more control over what comes out with our name on it than any other group in the business, which is not saying that we are completely free of compromise, because certain things have to be modified in order to just get it out there where it's going to do the most good. But we fight for the points that we want to make, you know, not against waiting a little while to achieve a certain end with the record company. And we have hassled with them a lot, threatened them up one side and down the other. And fortunately, they have responded, because during the past year, we've sold more than $1 million worth of goods for them, and they're beginning to like us a lot.
I understand that, I don't know if the rumor is true, that you come from the advertising business.
I was working, let me get this straight, I was not Madison Avenue Agogo. I was a national advertising director for a greeting card company in California. I prepared ads. I planned campaigns. I was a commercial artist, and I did greeting card designs, and that was my involvement with the advertising business as a person working in that field. But my knowledge of the operations of advertising as a business, and what I know about motivational research and certain other devious aspects of the business, you know, I found out by snooping around, and I've got a pretty good basic knowledge of those techniques.
Would you attribute a large part of your success to your ability to your position, your knowledge in the field of advertising, and ability to control people in such a way?
50% of where we are today is a direct result of the amount of work that I put out in controlling our image and in controlling the advertising companies which advertise our products through the record company. In other words, about 6 months ago, we took over the account from the Schneider Advertising Agency, which has the whole MGM company. You know, they take care of advertising for MGM Films and MGM Records. The whole spectrum of work is all done by Schneider, and I didn't feel that they were competent to advertise what we do, because they were advertising it on a really huckster level. I would see ads in places like the Village Voice that say, "The mothers of invention and all their scatological splendor." I puke, you know. So I went and had a giant argument with them, and they agreed that we could control our own graphics, our own copy, and everything that comes out in terms of promotion or promotional material, banners or in-store displays and stuff like that, is supposed to be approved by us before it goes out. It's a little bit rough to catch up with them, because sometimes they manufacture these things and there's a rush and some of the things sneak out without approval, but I'd say 80% of the printed matter that goes out on the group emanating from an advertising agency is thoroughly screened by our little company before it gets to the public, so that they don't say things about us which aren't true. No, they like to take certain shortcuts in order to sell the product, and I don't like to see them taking those shortcuts.
How did you manage to get involved and talk the MGM people, Verve, you are on Verve,
yeah,
label, into recording you in the first place?
when they first heard us, we were working at a club in Hollywood called the Whiskey a Go-Go. And the A&R man, producer, Tom Wilson, came in. He heard us play one song. It was the Watts Riot song. And that's sort of an R&B type thing. So he figures, oh, a topical R&B group, just what we need. So he phones up the company, oh, I got one, da-da-da-da. We get into the studio, you know, that was 2 months later, we go into the studio to record, and they didn't know what was happening. He got on the phone. First we did Any Way the Wind Blows. That was the first thing we recorded. And the second thing we did was Who Are the Brain Police? And by the time we finished Brain Police, his head was going around like this, you know, and he says, Lynn, what happened to that other one that I heard at the Whiskey a Go-Go? And he called back to New York and he said, we got something strange happening here. And the whole project just expanded incredibly. You know, everybody got real thrilled all of a sudden. They thought they really had a hot item on their hands. Then, the cost of recording Freak Out kept booming. Instead of starting off saying, well, you guys are real swell, we're going to give you $20,000, which is approximately four times the cost of the average rock and roll album to manufacture, and you're going to turn out one heck of a good album. Instead, they kept trying to keep the budget down, but it expanded up to $20,000. They reached that point. They didn't want to spend any more and figured, well, it'll sell. We'll spend $5,000 promoting it. So when it was finally put on the stands, our promotion budget on the album was what you'd call peanuts. Absolutely Free had a promotion budget of $25,000 and consequently got up to about number 20 on the charts. Freak Out never got up to number 20 on the charts, but it's still selling after about a year and a half. And it sells regularly between 4,000 and 8,000 copies a week, and it won't stop.
This brings up an interesting point. How much in sales and turnover would you attribute to promotion, and how much to what's actually on the record? In other words, could you sell any kind of noise you want to make with the proper promotion?
I'd say, judging from the product that many of the other groups put out, you can. But we would never do that.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting.
Packaging is very important, you know, and anybody in the business would, I'm sure, agree that the sales of a record, especially in a store where it's basically rack sales, are directly in proportion to the picture on the front of the record. You know, if you can't play the record, the only thing you got to go on is what that picture looks like. And if it turns you on, you'll buy the record on impulse, and if it doesn't, you're going to forget it.
I understand you're going to be doing something on TV in Detroit.
I did TV yesterday.
Got anything else coming up on television?
Well, there's a rumor that you're going to have your own show. No, but I'll tell you, we got a call about 4 days ago from the Monkees. And they have a show that they're going to do where each one of the Monkees gets to interview one of his favorite personalities from the world of music. And Mike Nesmith picked me, and Davy Jones picked, what's the other guy's name?
Mickey
Dolenz picked Tim Buckley. So we're going to film that when we're in Hollywood in December. I don't know when it'll be out, but it's probably...
Mickey Dolenz, picked you people, you know, to appear on this show. But
Tim,
like,
Buckley.
Tim Buckley and the other cat wanted you, but if you had to pick a group as far as presenting exciting trend, who would you choose? Are there any groups that
Eric
you are
Clapton.
With? Clapton.
Yeah. You ever talk with him?
No.
He's dynamite, man. I've never, you know, like, I have a lot of respect for him as a musician, but I was never so surprised until I sat down and talked with the cat, because he's really, you know, he's really into something.
Yeah. That's surprising to me, because Clapton is, you know, blues bag, so far as I can tell, quite deeply.
He's not exactly... He's not all blues. If you listen to what they're doing, he's made an attempt to take his blues background and mold it into something, you know, more original. When you hear them in person, a lot of their improvisation will start off with a theme based upon, like they'll start off with a song like Spoonful by the Howlin' Wolf, and they'll sing the words to that, but after that's over, they just go completely berserk and they're into something else. It's not all blues. It does grow out of blues. It's a completely different treatment of blues-oriented material than you'd find a Chicago blues band playing. Whereas most of the other blues groups start off funky, They stay funky when they blow, and when they get back to the original theme, they feel that not only are they ready to be funky all over again, but they might even be a little bit funkier because they have so much soul, as evidenced by the improvisations that they just laid on you. They're going to get it as close to the original record performance as they can, and that's their criteria for success. They feel that they have performed well if they play a song just like the record. Records which most of the young people, unfortunately, have not heard. But I grew up with those records. I was buying Howlin' Wolf records when I was 15, 16 years old, when they were playing them on the radio on R&B stations in California. You know, so, and Muddy Waters stuff. And I listen to these groups playing it now, and I say, are you kidding? You know, why bother? I don't know how they ever got into that sort of an unfortunate bag.
You obviously have a concern for what's happening. You want to do something about it.
Yeah.
Why do you choose the manner that you do?
I think it's the most expedient. You know, it's the easiest way to get what I have to do done. In a way, like I'm an appliance. I have a certain amount of ability to get people interested in certain things. I'm going to do everything I can to get people interested in the things that they should be interested in.
I don't know if this is attacking the people that should be, or
you know, I'm not really here to attack anybody. You know, if I do a thing in a song where I'm making fun of such and such a convention or putting somebody on, the attack itself is irrelevant. That doesn't mean anything. It's just the importance of what we do lies in the fact that somebody would just take the time to question a convention. Where a lot of people, they just take things for granted. They don't question anything. Yeah.
Do you think this is reaching these people who need the question?
Well, first of all, the real work of rebuilding a society, because that's the way I see it. You know, you don't have to tear it down, but it's possible that the society could be rebuilt from where it is now if people had the chops to do it. The actual work is going to be done by a bunch of people, not a vast majority of them, but like say maybe 500 or 600 people who are just weird enough to motivate other people to do these things. You know, there's always just certain people that in each town, in each social circle, that other people look to set trends and crap like that. It's like in high school, the first guy to wear his hair long, you know, weird crap, you know. But these are the people who have the ability to motivate change. And if we can reach them, we've done it. It's not so important that we reach all the people who are followers anyway.
Do you write poetry?
Well, my songs are poetry.
I know, but I mean just...
That's it.
That's it.
See, like people have a tendency now to think of art in boxes. You know? We got a poet here who may at times combine with... a playwright who may at times combine with a composer or a painter or a sculptor or a filmmaker, and everybody's in his own bag. Bullshit, I say. If you've got the ability to bring all these things together, why just spend your time working on, you know, little parts of bags? I think that a lot of people... well, it's like this. Suppose you were a plumber, you know, and you're used to working with your hands, and you have a certain amount of manual facility for, you know, just putting objects together. It's possible that if you lost your trade as a plumber, you could become a good carpenter, you know. And there are probably people now who are writing poetry that if they took the time to find out how to work the mechanics of music, could easily transform what they know and what they feel into the language of music and vice versa. But nobody's really taking the time to spread out that way.
I wanted to ask you about your trip to Europe. Do you find the kids there expressing their dissent? They must have the same feeling of disgust as we do, you know. But do they express themselves more the same way as, you know, you find here? Are there groups like yours that say that, you know, or what?
Yeah, there are some groups over there that really surprise you. Well, there was one group in England called the Ars Nova. I didn't get to hear them, but some of the other guys were at this club where they performed. And one of their songs was about 20 minutes long, included tape-recorded sound effects of a bombing raid. You know, and they're really into strange things. We were in Copenhagen, and there was another group that worked with us on the concert called the Maxwells. They looked sort of like the Beach Boys. They came out on stage and sang a 10-minute atonal Gregorian chant, and then rocked out into some really weird instrumental stuff. You know, at Copenhagen. And then there's this group in Sweden called the Tagus, which is a pretty popular group. You know, it may not be the number one group in Sweden, but they're pretty clean-cut looking guys. And I brought back two of their albums, and their stuff would really surprise you. So most of it is blues-oriented things, but some of the tricks they do with studio facilities and vocal effects, and they all sing in English, write their own songs in English. And there's weird things going on that nobody ever finds out about.
Yeah,
I just couldn't
find out. I mean, like,
you can write to Polydor Records. Or Parlophone distributes the Tagus albums. And then there's another group in England called Tomorrow that I really like. You ever heard them? They had a record out called My White Bicycle. I think they played it a couple of times in the United States. I really like what they're doing.
Do you find any difference in response between American and European audiences?
Yeah.
What?
The Europeans seem more critical, you know. You get the impression that if you played something, they would have some basis upon which to judge the quality of what you played. And you don't get that feeling from American audiences.
The message you're putting out is far more closely related to American audiences. Do you change this for the European audience, or do you let them listen to the American stuff?
First of all, most of the places we played, all the people spoke English. Second of all, the places we played in Europe had better PA systems than any places we played in the United States. The halls in Scandinavia are just fantastic. We had really good halls, good PA systems, and they could really hear what you were saying. And they understood 70% of it. And I didn't change anything. We just did just our normal stuff.
How old are you?
26.
What is your own personal musical background from which your music is developed?
I've played rhythm and blues since I was 15. I started out playing drums in a rhythm and blues band in San Diego. In those days, you didn't have groups, you had bands, and the emphasis was on instrumental music, not on vocal music. A band was fortunate if they had a singer. Usually, if they did have a singer, the guy was such an egomaniac that the band was overshadowed, so most of the good bands didn't even bother to have singers, and they all played their brains out. San Diego had a scene with heavy guitar players long before it was fashionable to have a heavy guitar player in the group. I remember hearing this one guy that I used to work with was a kid named Junior Madeo. He was really a good guitar player. And another guy named Manuel Flores. And, well, the names aren't, you know, anything spectacular, but these guys could really play. It was a different style of playing, but they're playing the blues because they had a different type of reason for playing the blues. Now, in 1955, when I was playing that stuff, they still had pachucos, they still had knives, they still had fights in the street, and they still punched you out at school, and it was really rough, you know, it was a nasty business, and that's the type of funky environment that would breed the type of music that the blues is, you know. It's the blues was initially a sort of protest music, and their brand of blues in San Diego was relevant to their environment, and it didn't sound like Chicago, it sounded like San Diego, and it expressed the feelings of the times, and it was all played by young people. But eventually it got corrupted into, like, all these kids grew up and they didn't record because it wasn't fashionable to play really blues in those days. They grew up and got themselves jobs playing songs like Misty in cocktail lounges in San Diego, or they play a bowling alley circuit where they play shuffle Louis Prima stuff.
A few minutes ago you were talking about poor areas in America. Riots and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What has been your experience with riots, and how do they relate to your
well,
message?
Well, the song that we have on the Freak Out album about the Watts riot was written during the riot, and I was offended by the fact that the riot occurred, not so much as the race problem itself, but by the fact that both sides appeared to be really stupid. It gets pretty gross to have to burn down your own house as a protest for some sort of socioeconomic condition. It's possible that that is the only answer, but I think with a little constructive thinking, you might be able to find other ways to solve racial problems.
Is your background lower class one?
I was lower middle class. I started out pretty poor, and gradually working up to we had a tract home, lived in a cardboard house. When I was really young, my father started out as a teacher of history at Loyola College in Maryland, and after that he went to work for the government as a meteorologist, and he was working at a place called Edgewood Arsenal during World War II, which made poison gas, and I remembered that the whole family, each member of the family, had their own gas mask in case the tanks broke, and we were living in these really flimsy housing units. It's really...
Did this create an alienation between you and your parents?
No,
I'm not pursuing any psychological...
No, but I never got alienated because my father was making poison gas and I grew up with a gas mask. I used to run around the yard with a thing on because I thought it was a space helmet.
What do you think of religion?
Organized religion is stupid. I think that God's alive and the church is dead.
How about the stuff the Beatles are doing?
What stuff?
They seem to have changed their style.
Their style of music? Or their style of living?
Both.
I think they're entitled to change to anything they want. I think that when you get that rich, anything that keeps you from being bored got to be really wonderful for you. Because I'm sure they've probably done just about everything there is to do. And I guess the Maharishi is the next logical step. And their new music, I like it. I like most of what the Beatles do, except when they do plastic versions of Chuck Berry. Shake It Up, Baby, a go-go.
What do you think is going to be next?
Somebody's got to prove to me first that psychedelic music exists. Really, let's be serious about this. If you say country and western, yes, that exists as a label for a type of music. But psychedelic, what is that? It's just a label that somebody in a company stuck on it. And right now they're using the same word to sell dresses in somebody's store.
Okay, well, what do you think the next gimmick's going to be?
The next gimmick? I don't know. You think of that. Anything. Somebody's going to put a band together that... the music is made on a 39 Chevy, and they've got contact microphones on different parts of the engine, and a special microphone that picks up the upholstery. And in live performance, they need very special amplifiers to get this sound across to the audience. Of course, they still have to have somebody standing out in front shaking a tambourine to keep the beat for the kids, but the rest of the music is very mechanical, organic. It comes right from the soul of the Chevrolet. And I think this is going to be one of the first really underground groups produced by Motown. It'll be a mixed group because some of the kids that'll be in the group will be Polish because they know how to work on the engine. After that, Youth Rebellion Fed. Yeah, let's see. Hey, the next step is the kids will all cut their hair off and go bald. I'm sure that'll happen.
Right in there, right in the beginning. What about the rest of the guys in the group?
Can you sort of give us a smattering of detail?
Sure. Billy Monday has an insane desire to crossbreed with an animal known as a yak, which he will discuss with you at length if you're interested. Jim Black used to drink 10 quarts of beer a day until he decided that it was making him feel bad. Then he stopped. He's kicked the habit, Roy Estrada is a lot happier now that he's not living with his parents. Ian Underwood is 28 years old and he looks like he's 14. Bump Gardner used to play swing band music as a member of the saxophone section of some big band. And Motorhead, our road manager who plays with the Dolls on stage, is a friend of mine that I've known since about 1956. And he's just bizarre. On tour in Europe, he was under instructions from his mother to take pictures of every church he saw and send them back to her. And he did. That's a little strange. They're just normal kids. No, they're from all over. And the average age of the group is about 30.
That was how things went last Monday afternoon in Detroit, as we talked about cabbages and kings and green things in general with the leader and musical director of the Mothers of Invention, Frank Zappa.
Hello, I'm here to tell you about the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. The Grandy is the only place of its kind in Michigan. You'll listen and dance to music of groups like The Rationals, The Spike Drivers, Scott Richard Cakes, Up, MC5, Paupers, Time, Cream, and many other magic people. And the light show is something you won't want to miss.